Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. How Oahu develops much-needed housing is tied to transit, but what if rail grinds to a halt before it ever runs? We'll talk about housing development with City Community Building Administrator Harrison Rue. Meanwhile, augmenting Kahuku's wind-driven power and a proposal to put turbines offshore is getting a lot of backtalk. Life of the Land's Henry Curtis shares his this hour.
I'm Chris Vandercook, and on this Memorial Day, we'll look at the combination of advanced intelligence, planning, and luck that led to decisive victory at the Battle of Midway with historian Burl Burlingame, and a historical preservation effort getting underway to keep alive the artifacts and the memories of the Pearl Harbor attack.
It's Monday, May 30th. The conversation starts after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. And good morning, Chris. It's been a while since I've had the chance to say that to you.
Yeah, I should be welcoming you. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. Good to be home. And good to be with you on this Memorial Day. All the things that we've talked about over the years, we keep coming back to one conversation about Hawaii's energy future. And we know that Hawaii's need for energy will continue to increase along with its growing population. On Oahu, Kahuku is already home to wind-driven power. This time last year, Napua Makani Power Partners unveiled a plan to add 10 turbines next door to the current wind farm. The current scheme calls for fewer but taller turbines. That presents changes to the original environmental impact statement. Meanwhile, two companies are floating plans for offshore turbines to produce roughly a quarter of Oahu's current needs, but that's speculation at this point. Here to comment on all of the land and sea turbines is Life of the Land Executive Director Henry Curtis. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning, Beth Ann, and welcome back.
Thank you so much. Let's talk first about this idea to put turbines offshore. I mean, there's no place that we can point to that says, look, there they are, and this is what they do. So this is all kind of speculation, maybe a really good idea. But how do you assess an idea like this that's going to take us 10 years out when we know technology kind of hasn't been developed to exactly do this, and yet it's also going to be changing pretty rapidly in the next 10 years, too?
It's really difficult because, first, there are no offshore wind systems in the entire United States. And the offshore systems that exist in Europe tend to be in very shallow water and to be anchored into the seabed. So this would be cutting-edge technology that would be developed over the next 10 years off the coast. And we know that two companies have bid. A third one is about to bid. And it's more locking in a piece of territory without having an idea of exactly what it will be.
And what about financial commitment to be able to make this happen?
Apparently, all you need is a company with a financial balance sheet that says, as of now, it sounds good.
That sounds a little iffy.
It is very iffy, and the two existing bidders are concerned that the bar is so low, anybody else can come in, make a third bid, undercut them, and then have 10 years to develop something.
But the reality is that they don't really know how much this is going to cost because this is technology yet to be developed. How do we assess all that?
It's extremely difficult to assess at this point. And there'll need to be very comprehensive environmental studies, actually two rounds, one looking at the lease and then a second one down the road after somebody actually proposes something.
At this point, any sense of when that something might actually be proposed, something more concrete than just an idea?
In general terms, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management will be putting out basically a request for parties, for entities to make a bid, and that will probably be next year or the year after.
So, I mean, this is going to be an ongoing situation and not necessarily one that we have a lot of facts on which to base an opinion.
Right. The most important thing now is for the residents of this state to determine what type of energy they want in the future and whether ocean energy is a possibility or not. That is, if people don't want it, that should come out early. On the other hand, it gives the proponents an opportunity over time to persuade people.
You're talking about type of energy. For a long time, we've been talking about types of energy and the fact that we are looking more at a portfolio. We've been talking about that for at least 15 years.
We have. And the ocean, we can think about wind offshore. You could think about solar offshore, ocean thermal offshore, wave energy offshore. And whether you want to industrialize the ocean, whether you want to say, well, the ocean 10, 20 miles out, nobody or few people are out there, and why not put power there instead of on the land? There are many alternatives that we need to begin discussing.
For some people who hear you say begin to discuss, they're bristling because they think, well, haven't we been discussing this for a very, very long time? Haven't we?
We have, but the technology is so rapidly changing in the last few years. The growth of solar, the rooftop solar, distributed power, things are in rapid flux. And yes, we have been discussing them for a long time, but it's the changes in the last 5 years have been so great that the dynamic picture has really changed.
Some would also say, well, isn't that kind of what we expect to happen as we move into the future, too, that technology will continue to change and maybe incredibly rapidly, as we've seen in past?
Yes, and I think the telecommunications revolution is an example of how rapidly cell phones are changing and the technology is changing. And the energy sector is about to take off that way, both in terms of generation, in terms of efficiency, and in terms of storage. So it would be a rapid change.
Which might be an argument for sitting back and waiting a little bit to see how that begins to change, perhaps?
Right. There'll be those who will be leading. There'll be those who will be standing back and wanting to be second or third. And there are those who will want to resist the entire thing. Hawaii is near the forefront right now, but the choice is how close to the edge we want to be.
Not at the edge, but something that's been going on for a while is the wind farm at Kahuku. And last week, the meeting where a lot of people were very concerned about having more wind turbines put there in general, albeit maybe fewer than the original plan called for. At this point, having those turbines that would be maybe 100 feet taller than what had been proposed, is that a good idea, even though there would be maybe fewer of them?
I think Kahuku stands as a cautionary tale that if you agree to something in your backyard, it will be harder to fight the second, the third, and the fourth. And the developer there, I don't think, has done a good job of meeting with the community, of figuring out what is acceptable and what isn't. There are some European countries that are talking about the height of the turbine versus how close you get to urban areas. And so there are many different opportunities, but any developer who proposes a large-scale project should be willing to state up front that they will leave if not supported by the local community.
You talk about the height versus the proximity to neighborhoods. What specifically do you mean when you say that there is a relationship there? What is there? Is there a best practices?
I believe
that we don't see followed here?
I believe that some places are considering the height from the ground to the top of the spinner and saying that that distance, if you multiply it by, say, 10, that is how close you can come to a building. Hawaii does not have any boundary restrictions.
So at this point, people can comment until, what, June 7th?
I believe so, and they should comment if they're concerned, yes.
All right, Henry, we'll see how this one plays out, too. Thanks for coming in on this Memorial Day.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Henry Curtis is the executive director of the organization Life of the Land.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Coming up, memories of the battle that reversed the momentum of the Pacific War. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about one of the men interred at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific. When Punchbowl Cemetery finally opened to the public in 1949, with services honoring five war dead, there was one civilian among them. He was one of the Second World War's most celebrated journalists, a war correspondent who insisted on telling stories of war from the ordinary soldier and sailor's point of view. He wrote a syndicated column that appeared in 300 newspapers around the country, becoming a beloved voice of the common man. His efforts won him a Pulitzer Prize in 1944 and the praise of then-Vice President Harry Truman, who wrote, quote, "No man in this war has so well told the story of the American fighting man as American fighting men wanted it told. He deserves the gratitude of all his countrymen," end quote. He was killed by a Japanese sniper on an island off the northern coast of Okinawa on April 18, 1945. This morning, we're looking for his name, and we'll be back with it in about a half an hour. Here's a hint, though. If you're a longtime listener, you may remember a segment we did with the foundation that bears his name. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get it right gets the HPR T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Rady Coito from Malama, Mauna Loa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The Japanese Empire won a decisive victory with its 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor and was on its way to mastery of the Pacific with all the momentum in its favor until Midway, a naval battle fought in early June of 1942, 6 months later. The fearsome and previously invincible Japanese fleet was never the same after Midway, but even then it would be four long years before the Empire surrendered. It's a battle that yields many lessons, and Pacific Aviation Museum Pearl Harbor historian Burl Burlingame is with us to sort them out. Good morning, Burl.
Good morning.
The Pacific Aviation Museum is mounting a memorial to the battle with these murals, yeah?
In ways. The thing about battles and battlefields is, you know, the word field, and
yeah.
Every battle is a tussle for a piece of property,
mm-hmm.
in one way or another. But in the Pacific, the pieces of property are little specks of land out in the middle of an ocean.
Right.
And the Battle of Midway, you know, ranged over an area like the size of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And so memorializing that in a way that people can access,
yeah.
you know, in a physical way is kind of tough.
There's no San Juan Hill, right?
There is. You know, the weather and the, you know, ravages of time take away the physical reminders of battle.
Yeah.
And also, you know, establishing presences across the Pacific. And the thing about the Pacific War was never really about the Pacific. It was always about China and Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese believed the Pacific would be a big barrier because of its immense size. But essentially, they wanted to draw the U.S. fleet into a final battle in which one side would win.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese are always really good at tactics and not at strategy. And they wanted this, you know, final battle. But also, if that didn't succeed, they were going to take Midway and use that as a stepping stone towards the invasion of the Hawaiian Islands. Midway is part of the Hawaiian Islands. But they never really thought beyond taking Midway. And I don't know how they would have supplied it and, you know, been able to carry on something.
That was a big flaw in their Pacific War effort in general, wasn't it?
Well, they kept believing that if they really did a decisive battle, the Americans would just give up. which never happened.
Which Yamamoto warned against, right?
And also never happened on their side.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Which is why it came to a really grinding halt, you know, 3.5 years later. But what remained on Midway is not just the reminders of battle, but the reminders of aerial presence in the Pacific, mm-hmm. Because Midway really became important only because of aviation. And no matter where you go, you have to get refueled. And Midway was a key part of that process. And so the structures that grew up on Midway were created by Pan Am, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Navy moved in. It became, you know, Naval Air Station, Midway Atoll. Mm-hmm. And we should call it Midway Atoll, not Midway Island. There is no real Midway Island because it's an atoll. But the things that are there have deteriorated over the years. And the reminders of that period, you know, they're being eaten by termites. They're being ravaged by wind and rain and just, you know, sunlight. And there were some murals that were inside the theater there that were painted by a CB artist during 1943, 44,
mm-hmm.
maybe even into 45, that they used to decorate the inside of the theater. And when I was a kid flying across the Pacific with my parents, we stopped at Midway, and I remember those murals mm-hmm. from like 1960. And they were something that was really emblematic of that particular theater, which was located right in the middle of Sand Island. And so Fish and Wildlife came to the point where the building was so compromised that they took the murals down and they asked our museum to come up with a way of stabilizing the murals. Now, they were painted on the backs of masonite, 4x12-foot boards that were glued to plywood. And the masonite was reversed. So the pebbly side of masonite, which sort of resembles canvas, was sticking mm-hmm. out, and he painted it on top of that. But termites had eaten the back so much that these whole things that were, you know, 8 by 12 feet were like soggy soda crackers. I mean, just really flimsy. And so I came up with a design that stabilized them, which required welding together steel frames and using other types of treated plywood and gluing the whole thing down with foam filling and glues. And so they're stabilized, and we have an agreement now with Fish and Wildlife to display these for a certain period of time. And we finished the stabilization and brought in conservators to teach us about cleaning them. By the way, white vinegar works really well,
mm-hmm.
and big Q-tips. And by the way, white vinegar cleans everything in your kitchen. So, Beth,
well, so these murals are going on display at the museum.
They are up now, but the big revelation will be during our air show, which mm-hmm. happens to be on the anniversary.
Right.
Of the Midway Battle, and it's this upcoming weekend, and it's the biggest little air show, and it's really the only flying air show in Hawaii these days. And you can see some amazing flying going on. It's fun for kids, and they're even, you know, bringing in a snow machine to make a snow mountain for kids to jump into.
Burl, you've also got a memorial of the battle, and I just want to go back to something you said earlier about mm-hmm. the Battle of Midway, which is that the Japanese were good at tactics and not good at strategy. Meaning what? Meaning that they were good at executing a battle, but not at putting it in its long-term context? What happens then?
Well, you just explained it.
Okay, well, that's
basically
my question.
The Japanese believed wars were won on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a warrior mentality. You know, you smite the enemy, and that's it. Everyone else gives up. And the warrior is the representative of the people.
Mm-hmm.
In America, however, the people are the warriors. And so we tend to think of things in a, you know, it's not just one on the battlefield, it's one in the factories, it's one in the, you know, fuel lines, it's one in transport and the whole thing. In the American military, only like 1 out of 100 people actually do fighting.
Fights,
everything
yeah.
else is support for that guy on the front mm-hmm. line. And that's the way it works. And the Japanese never were really good at supply lines. They never were very good at holding positions.
You could argue that both the Germans and the Japanese ran out of gas at the end of the Second World War.
They absolutely did, and so were the Japanese. And the other thing to remember is in China, which was their real objective, the Japanese were essentially winning the war up until the last day
mm-hmm.
and advancing. And then along came the atomic bombs, plus the Soviet invasion of and decimation of the Kwantung Army, which is Japan's largest and best army. And if the Soviets had kept going another week or so, they would have been in Hokkaido. And that's when the Japanese really decided to throw in the towel.
It also shows you how quixotic the nature of war is, that that you can have a defeat snatched from the jaws of victory, as you just described, right?
The Japanese had a very good plan. One of the things they did when they planned their tactical assaults is they overthought them and did timetables. And basically every timetable in the world disappears in the smoke of battle.
Yeah, and that's a military axiom if there ever was one, right?
Exactly. And I think Stephen Crane invented it. But essentially, they had timetables, and when the enemy didn't do as they wished, their timetables were thrown off. And essentially, that's in bottom line, that's sort of what happened at Midway. Mm-hmm. We threw off their timetable, and they weren't able to refuel and rearm their airplanes in a timely manner, and opened a window in which our guys could nail them.
Well, it's something that we all need to know more about. So thanks very much for coming in.
Knowledge and flexibility are the key to success.
Well said. Burl Burlingame is the Pacific Aviation Museum Pearl Harbor's resident historian. He'll be part of an educational panel on the Battle of Midway this Friday, June 3rd, at the Pacific Aviation Museum Pearl Harbor. The museum is also commemorating the 74th anniversary of the Battle of Midway by unveiling six murals that were painted during the Second World War on the walls of the Navy Theater at Midway Atoll. It's part of the museum's 9th annual Biggest Little Air Show this weekend. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Who carries the stories of war? Who tells those stories?
If you want to know the war, look at the wound that it inflicts. Look at the response, look at the outcome, because that really is what war means.
A British historian investigating World War I discovers the overlooked stories of the wounded and their caregivers. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
$9.15. That's how much it costs to run this statewide network every minute of every day. And that comes to $13,000 a day, $92,000 a week. These members understand balancing a budget, and we're infinitely grateful for their support. Janet Kato of Honolulu, Angela De Almeida of Kapolei, and Lucy Woodward of Wailuku. If HPR adds quality to your life, we invite you to become a member of Hawaii Public Radio at hawaiipublicradio.org, which is open every minute of every day.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer school for boys and girls in preschool through grade 12, with classes in digital media, art, robotics, and more. Full course listings at sacredhearts.org.
It was a big weekend for Democrats. The state convention physically brought together Clinton and Sanders factions, but can the calls for party unity philosophically solidify under a new party leader? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann, and welcome back.
Thanks so much. This seemed to be the division of the party elite and grassroots, and looking at how the choice was made, it looks like grassroots won.
Well, you know, in some ways, there were probably more Clinton supporters overall, just representative of the party. But remember that amazing caucus turnout in March in which Sanders people, by a 70 to 30% margin, prevailed in the presidential preference poll. And clearly, the Sanders folks were there in force yesterday. They were yesterday and Saturday. They were vocal. They were all over the place. And their victory culminated with the election of Tim Vandeveer, who, of course, has his HBR connections. He's the new party chair. He's a very strong Sanders supporter. And that certainly sent a message and captured, I think, the essence of what happened this weekend.
And looking at where we go from this point, of where you have some, you know, deeply philosophical differences between the two candidates, albeit all under the umbrella of being a Democratic Party member, what happens from this point forward, you think, as we see a changing landscape with Mark Takai saying he's not going to run, but seemingly virtually to, if not endorse, at least show support for Colleen Hanabusa.
Right, and Mark Takai wasn't there yesterday. He was in D.C. resting, had someone read a statement on his behalf. He pretty much indicated that he'd like to have Colleen Hanabusa take his place. She's expected to announce that she will be running for that seat probably this week, certainly by next June 7th. That's the deadline. But going forward, you know, I think all eyes right now are on what happens in California and New Jersey on June 7th. That's the final day of the primary season. And should the Sanders people prevail in California, and right now the polls are tight, boy, they certainly will have the wind behind them as they head to Philadelphia for the convention. Having said that, it's almost certain that Clinton will have clinched the necessary delegates by that time as well. So we'll see. I think the main point that folks like Governor David Ige were stressing was unity, and folks like Mazie Hirono and Brian Schatz are saying, we've got to defeat Donald Trump.
And those things of the Donald Trump part of it, maybe everybody gets behind that, but the idea of unity, the question might be when.
Exactly. And remember, 4 years ago, excuse me, 8 years ago, Hillary Clinton stayed in the race, I believe, all the way until California. I think she actually won California 8 years ago. But remember, it was Barack Obama who was elected president.
All right. Well, Will, we don't have long to see how this is going to play out. And there'll be lots more to talk about with you for our next Reality Check. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a Reality Check.
At 8:30, you're tuned to The Conversation, statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Talk back about what you hear on the show to our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up later, an effort to restore the moorings along Battleship Row. Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, when you got back and neck pain, everything hurts, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. But, you know, we're going to talk today with a neurosurgeon, and we're going to find out what particular types of pain and problems require surgery versus which ones do not. Because, you know, a lot of people think that you can just cure a lot of different problems with, you know, arthritis of your back or disc ruptures and everything with surgery, when in fact neurosurgery is somewhat limited as to how much it can really fix some of the damage we do to our body. So we're going to talk about what are those criteria and why isn't everybody with back pain needing surgery and why surgery is not really the best answer for a lot of folks.
Well, Kathy, aren't there some pains you can kind of exercise your way out of, but then some where you really shouldn't try to do that?
Exactly. And so there's ways that people will feel differently in those situations. You know, if you have a muscle problem, you should stretch and exercise your way out of it. If you have a problem where the nerve is compromised, then doing some of those same stretches could actually harm you. So it's really important to know the difference. And sometimes you can tell that based on how you feel, but sometimes you actually need an expert to give you a little bit more direction.
It doesn't sound as if you want to leave too much to chance in that area, Kathy.
You really don't. You know, for people who like, hey, I lifted up a heavy box, I shouldn't have done it, they can fix their posture when they're lifting. It's pretty simple. But as things get more complicated, and particularly with areas around the neck, you know, the neck is, if you have a serious neck problem, that can affect the entire rest of your body. So that's why you have to be so careful when we're dealing with really anything to do with the spine.
Well, we'll look to hear more about that. Thanks a lot, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, tonight at 5.
Hi, good morning. I'm Lee Stack from the Chinatown Improvement District. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
For years, Honolulu officials have tied developing housing, including affordable rentals, to the rail route. With continued escalating costs, there's now the question of whether rail will be completed as originally envisioned, and if that happens, what will that mean for much-needed housing development? Harrison Rue is the Community Building and Transit-Oriented Development Administrator for the City and County of Honolulu. He's in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth.
And thanks for coming in. We've been talking for a long time about what do you do to increase housing around an area where people can live, work, and play. We've talked about that for 10, 12 years. And now that's been very much tied to transit-oriented development. As that begins to move and change, what happens to housing as you see it from a development plan where we just don't have lots of land that we can expand into to create some of the, you know, communities that have been fully planned in other states?
Well, I think the principles that we're working under in transit-oriented development are really pretty time-tested. We know what great neighborhoods look like here on Oahu. Top of the Hill in Kaimuki, Wailea, was originally a trolley car suburb. So we know what that mix needs to be to make a great place where people walk and connect. But we've also seen what happens over time when a place like that becomes, you know, the rail that was taken away, the original trolley car, and then it became auto-oriented, and then they widen the road and it becomes unwalkable. And you're starting to see places like that restored a little bit. But I think it's really important to make the transit system work as a piece of the overall system. It's not just transit or rail or bus. It's car share, bike share, parking management, and rail access, making the streets and crossing safer for people.
We've had such difficulty in creating, for example, bike paths, just bike paths alone. When you talk about restoring neighborhoods, including places like Wailea and others, where you can still see that there are trolley car route that used to be there, or down the Kalani-Anioli Highway, same thing. There seems to be this idea that, well, maybe we've made some real mistakes in the past, and how is it that we can prevent those from recurring in the future as we're sort of cycling back to creating neighborhoods that really do act as neighborhoods?
Sure. I think it's all part of one system. My day job is focusing on transit-oriented development and looking at enhancing the neighborhoods around each of the planned rail stops. So we've gone out with city staff and neighborhood folks and looked at all the neighborhoods and ways to better connect existing neighborhoods as well as new development to the rail. But it's not just about, what rail will give you is a quick way, reliable way, even in great traffic jams to get longer distance. But you still need to have within a half a mile or a mile of the station really needs to be made much more walkable. And that's one of the things that development can help us do as it occurs over time. Part of the city's proposed new zoning codes would require developers to make enhancements in existing sidewalks, intersections, safer pedestrian crossings, bike lanes, things like that, as the development occurs.
When you walk through or drive through Honolulu proper, it's pretty evident that there wasn't a lot of planning that was happening that was long-term. A lot of it looks very piecemeal. You can sort of see where different pieces were attached at different times. Looking at the more industrial side, where Ivalea is now, and some of the conversation of, well, will there be housing development there? What kind of housing will there be? How dependent on rail is that? And do we need to be looking at these things as separate questions?
Let's look at that as two parts of the question. First, your premise that there wasn't planning. There was planning. It was just auto-oriented like all the other 49 states. So, people assumed that we would continue growing outward and we'd need to keep widening the roads for people to commute from the suburbs into town. And that was the plan, 30, 40 years ago. So we followed the plan, but, the new plans really need to change and say the
old plan wasn't
inner
a good
city
plan.
And, there are the places that we've already built, we need to restore them. So within that context, the Ivalea-Kapalama area is a place that could see significant change. Because there's large landowners, both private and public sector. I don't really think that really happens unless the people who live there have access to all the rest of the jobs. There's jobs in town, jobs at Pearl Harbor. We have, I think, 40% of the city's jobs are within walking distance of a planned rail station. That's unheard of. It's second only to New York City. So that's one reason we know this will work and really improve people's lives because they have access to jobs throughout the corridor.
Are you at all concerned that if the plan for rail changes, that we're going to have to tweak how we look at housing?
Sure. The decision about rail and route and things like that is way above my pay grade. But as a planner focusing on enhancing the neighborhoods around the rail stations, I just worry that whatever decision is made takes too long. We're back to square one, and we have an affordable housing crisis right now. A lot of our plans to increase affordable housing supply focus on TOD. I think FACE, Reverend Bob Nakata and his group FACE have been strong supporters of rail solely because of its strong potential to really increase affordable housing supply that's well located. There's a new approach sponsored by HUD and Center for Neighborhood Technology to look at combined housing and transportation costs. And we're used to thinking, people can pay 30% or a third of their income on housing. And, that when you apply for a mortgage, you're used to that formula. When you look at the combined housing and transportation costs here in Oahu, the average is 52%, in terms of what people pay, combined housing and transportation. A third, over a third, 35%, 343,000 people here spend 54 to 66% of their income on housing and transportation. 127,000 people here pay 66 to 78% of their income on housing and transportation. So if we can provide affordable housing in an area that they can ride rail, ride bus, walk to work, that kind of thing, they don't have to have a car, they can afford that third bedroom in the unit. There's a real $50,000 for average structured parking. That's the cost of a third bedroom.
Which is to say, though, given the case that you just built for it, means that there's all the more concern if there isn't the transit part of that composition. So in putting these neighborhoods back together, because in some cases it feels like, we have to jump to the past to bring it forward again and understand that neighborhoods need to function as neighborhoods. Are there things that you see that just absolutely have to be there in addition to the transportation? I mean, I'm talking about mixed use and understanding that it's okay to, have people living above, as once they were, living above stores?
Sure. We don't need to make any of this stuff up. This is not a planner's dream. It's just observations of places that really work. So places within walking distance to shop and to worship and to connect and to learn. There's a reason why our tagline is not live, work, play. It's live, work, connect. Because the way that we build can connect people with each other in terms of social gathering places, shopping, working. And it can connect you. If you have a long-distance spine that is not stuck in traffic, it connected you with your families, out in Pearl Ridge or Waipahu or Kapolei. I'm struck by the miracle we had with Zipmageddon. You remember that?
Mm.
The entire city was shut down because we just lost two lanes for a few hours.
Remember that one vividly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is there anything that particularly concerns you or worries you as we're having this conversation where we are right now, looking at where rail is right now, and obviously the need that we've talked about for such a long time for affordable housing?
I just think we need to make a decision, follow it, stick with the game plan, and then get to really building housing for people who need it.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thanks very much for coming in. Harrison Rue is the Community Building and Transit-Oriented Development Administrator for the City and County of Honolulu.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a Second World War correspondent who insisted on telling stories in his own way. His syndicated column, which appeared in 300 newspapers, didn't look at the war from the command perspective. He was interested in the daily lives of the men who served and wrote about their gripes and their jokes, along with the hard facts of combat. He began his work as a war correspondent in the European Theater, where he covered the North Africa campaign and the Normandy invasion. He came to the Pacific in the last year of the war and was shot and killed by a Japanese sniper near Okinawa in April of 1945. His gravestone at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific reads, Ernest Taylor Pyle, Indiana, SEA 3, U.S. Navy, World War I, Purple Heart. It's Ernie Pyle we're thinking of, and that's our quiz for today.
And Lee Myers called in from Honolulu, knew the answer, and not from looking at the hat in my office. Thanks so much for playing the Backyard Quiz with us now at 8:45. If you've got a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Compassion and Choices, a nonprofit committed to improving care and expanding choice at the end of life. Learn more about contributing personal stories at CompassionandChoicesHawaii.org.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. Look out for Mars, Saturn, and the bright star Antares in the constellation of Scorpius. All three of these objects will be in your southern sky. Now, they're very, very bright. They rise pretty late in the evening, around about 9 o'clock, but they make for a stunning summer triangle. Also, look out for the moon, which is waning this week.
Christopher apparently has something about climate change on one of the planets in our solar system.
I do indeed. Researchers using data from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft have been studying climate change on the red planet. Findings from the team seem to indicate that Mars is emerging from an ice age that has lasted 370,000 years. The spacecraft has been taking high-resolution images of the Martian polar caps and also Martian glaciers, and data shows that these glaciers are retreating in the more warmer latitudes, and the polar caps are gaining a little bit more ice. This is behavior that is typical of an ice age.
I get it. So by looking at images taken at one point and then a few years later, you can start to make the kind of conclusions that you're talking about.
You got it. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has been orbiting the red planet for an awful long time now.
So it seems like what you're indicating is the temperature is rising there, yet I've got to believe it's still quite chilly.
Oh yeah, Mars is frigidly cold for most of the Martian year. The temperatures on Mars can fluctuate wildly during the day and night as well as between summer and winter. On a good summer day on Mars, you can expect highs of around about 80 degrees Fahrenheit. But for most of the year, the temperature hovers around a bone-chilling minus 100 degrees.
How can it fluctuate so wildly like that?
Well, unfortunately for Mars, it doesn't have an atmosphere to trap in heat like the Earth does. And so it doesn't have a greenhouse effect. Now, the greenhouse effect here on the Earth gets a little bit of a bad rap, but it actually keeps us very toasty. Without it, the Earth would freeze solid.
So does this mean that a potential end to Mars's ice age might bring about warm enough temperatures that it would be seasonable enough for people to actually be there?
Well, unfortunately, I wouldn't expect to be sipping Mai Tais on a beach on Mars anytime soon. In fact, it will probably take thousands of years, if that, for Mars to become warm like the Earth, if at all.
Christopher Phillips, thank you so much for the report.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Historical events change the nature of ordinary objects. They become the artifacts of a day the world should never forget. When the Japanese Empire's bombers destroyed the pride of America's Pacific Fleet in that early morning surprise attack on December 7th, 1941, they were tied to their moorings, easy prey. Minette Lou McCabe is a development officer at Pacific Historic Parks. She's leading an effort to get those moorings restored, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Minette.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let's describe what this effort is.
Well, first off, it's a little confusing. There's the effort to preserve the battleship mooring keys. Again, is it key, K, or quay? Well, actually, they're all correct. I prefer the British pronunciation of key. But they're now about 75 years old, a little more than that, constructed in 1934, circa around that time. And due to two things, the damage from the actual attack, which was actually pretty minimal. And then the damage or deterioration after 75 years of being in a marine environment, the water has caused the steel, the rebar, and other just steel within the things to rust, the bolts, and they expand, physically expand, which causes the concrete to crack and fall up. So they're now falling into the water, and pretty much if you don't do anything, they're going to disappear completely. So with that, we thought it was a good time to be in the restoration effort.
Manette, if this effort doesn't go underway, it's a highly visible ruin, right?
Yes, it'll be pretty much they're the last remaining physical artifacts from the attack.
Mm-hmm.
And now is the time because damage will begin to escalate and there's going to be no going back. So pretty much they're launching, you know, this effort right now while, you know, the generation that experienced it is still around and has, you know, really cares about it. From a fundraising aspect, this is the time to do it when people can still remember.
Before the deterioration continues,
yes.
Right? You were also telling me that for someone of your generation who is a couple of generations removed from living memory of the Second World War, that these artifacts are especially important.
Yes. Again, I only heard about it from my grandparents. So while I understand the historic importance of it, it's a lot harder for me to just understand. The closest that I have experienced to something like this was 9/11 in my lifetime. And mm-hmm. So I realized the impact of it. However, if there is no physical structure for me to look at, it's harder for me to imagine what went on. So I think that, you know, having something physically there is very important for my generation and the much younger millennial generation now.
Well, because when you're in a place like that, you want to be able to, for one thing, get a sense of scale, yeah?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, there are 16 pairs of them on the south side of, I mean, sorry, 8 pairs of them, and they were on the south side of Ford Island.
Mm-hmm.
And the most Malka 3 are the ones that are part of the World War II Valentine Pacific National Monument, and the Arizona being tied to one of them. So they're quite visible.
How much is it going to cost to get these back to? And you want them in the state they were in that morning in 1941, right?
Well, that's actually a tricky question. Among preservation, they have not determined a plan yet. With preservation, you try to do as little as possible that, you know, pretty much what you need to do. Mm-hmm. So there's been discussion, and it's going to involve all the stakeholders on exactly what the plan of preservation is going to be. And, you know, there's always a debate. Do you make them look brand new? Do you make them look like, you know, they were right after attack? So it's a little tricky right now, and they can't quite say yet. And it's going to, you know, they're going to follow the Secretary of Interior standards for preservation and then construction industry best practices and involve the input of all stakeholders first before they actually determine the plan. Also, we're a little bit hesitant to say the actual cost, but estimated right now will take 5 years and about $5 million.
You're getting some help in, assuming that your costs are met, you're getting some help in the actual restoration effort, aren't you?
Well, we have been selected as one of 20 national parks to compete in the Partners of Preservation grant competition. Partners in Preservation consists of the National Trust for Historic Preservation and American Express, and they're providing $2 million in funding. We are competing for a share of that. We requested $250,000 to launch this Memorial Keys restoration. And the winners will be determined by strictly public voting on the National Geographic website. It started last week Wednesday and runs to July 5th. The top vote getters, the top 5 out of the 20 parks, will receive their full funding request.
So people have an opportunity to weigh in on the importance of this,
yes,
this effort, right?
The restoration of the Maury Keys is going to happen regardless, but this would be a huge boost to kind of launch that effort. So it is a nice chunk of money, and we definitely hope that we get it.
Yeah.
And but I think as of this morning, we were in fourth place. So if we just maintain that ranking, we should get our full funding. So please vote.
So local people can kind of make a difference in this, yeah?
Yes. We need you to go online, go to www.voteyourpark.org mm-hmm. and log in with your email or Facebook and vote every day for us. You could also win a trip to Yellowstone as part of it.
Can you vote? When you say vote every day, can you vote more than once?
if you vote with maybe a different email or a different account, yes. But it's pretty much one vote for – you can vote up to five parks, actually.
Uh-huh.
But definitely make sure you vote for Pearl Harbor. We're the only Hawaii park. We're up against some big, heavy hitters. And
well, we wish you luck.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Minette. Minette Lou McCabe is the development officer at Pacific Historic Parks, a nonprofit that supports various park sites in Hawaii and the Pacific. And a free open house is being held at the Pearl Harbor Visitor Center the weekend of June 18th and 19th to promote the Mooring Keys project.
In the Bay Area of Northern California, they're considering taxing themselves to create buffers for climate-related sea level rise.
It's an accelerated problem. We have to work harder. We have to start sooner. We have to do the things we can do today to be able to get ready for 4 to 6 feet.
How they do it, who's complaining, and why. I'm Steve Kerwin, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
This afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
Many reasons to reflect upon history, many obvious reasons to reflect upon history on this Memorial Day, but we had a couple of people to do just that.
Reflect on it and pass it on.
Yeah.
Just listening this morning to a piece that was talking about the new roots that's going to be airing tonight and the mm-hmm. fact that, you know, 50% of those around now weren't there when that was first around. Think about how many people weren't around, obviously, to know a lot about history of the Second World War as a firsthand account or having it passed along. So a good reason to sit down and have a good conversation.
That's right.
With the young people in your life. We'll have more conversation coming up with you tomorrow. We're going to check in with Neil Conan. And with so much community sort of caregiving happening in the hands of nonprofits, what makes good board leadership? We're going to find out.
And at last, a film festival that puts kids first. Somebody actually asked them what they wanted to see.
That's a good thing to do. Meanwhile, another good thing might be let us know how you like or don't some of the things that you hear on our station and on The Conversation. You can always get to us at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of the show or want a past one, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.